All right, our first paper this morning is on Record Makers and Breakers of New Orleans. We are very fortunate to have a renowned author, a man who's been researching the music of this region for more than 40 years. His first book in 1974 was Walking to New Orleans, The Story of New Orleans R&B, republished a few years later as Rhythm and Blues in New Orleans, and he's had several books since then. He certainly has spoken to personally many, if not most, of the movers and shakers in New Orleans and can give us, I think, an excellent overview of the musical development of this area in the last 50-plus years. Let me introduce to you John Brovin.
Thank you very much, Tim. Thank you. Thank you, Tim. And I must say thank you, Mr. President, for inviting me to this 44th annual conference. I readily recall when I first flew into New Orleans in 1970, looking down at the bright lights that hugged the Mississippi River. And as I wrote in Walking to New Orleans, could it be down there that Fats Domino, Professor Longhair, Huey Smith, Alan Toussaint, Earl King, Ernie K. Doe, and Lee Dorsey made their names and actually live? That was the wondrous effect that New Orleans had on me. I must quickly bring ourselves up to date. Yesterday, I went to the reception. I wanted to go to Jim Russell's record store on Magazine Street, and I just wanted to check the street number. And I asked a young lad, could I have the telephone directory, please? Telephone directory? Oh, you mean Yellow Pages. So then I duly looked up the section for record shops. Record shops? Ladies and gentlemen, this is 2010. I'd like to take you back to the beginning as to how my research came about and resulted in actually three books. It began at Bexhill Grammar School in 1958 in Sussex, England. England, of course, when I found myself in the same class as Mike Leadbitter, who was already displaying considerable vision in finding out the stories behind the rock and roll records that entranced us. We subsequently found out there literally was a story behind every record, whether it was a hit or not, and that was the fascination. With Mike, it wasn't just the hits of the day. It wasn't Bill Haley, it wasn't Elvis Presley, even Fats Domino. Instead, it was records like You Can't Catch Me by Chuck Berry, C.C. Rider by Chuck Willis, and a Bo Diddley EP from Checker with his first recordings. All came out in England on the wonderful London American label, who were licensing the masters from the independent companies. And how about this record in Mike's collection? Flirty Gertie by the Jivertones on Felsted. Such was high art at the time. I well remember getting ready for the school mock examinations when Mike came up to me and said, I know where Fats Domino makes his records. This is 1958. And I said, where? He said, Cosmo Studios in New Orleans. You see, the London American records of the time just displayed the label which said, recorded by Imperial Hollywood, not New Orleans. After that revelation, the exams disappeared into insignificance. The voyage of discovery had begun, and also a lifetime of collecting. And I do emphasize collecting records and enjoying them. One Saturday morning in 1961, I was attending my local record shop in Eastbourne, Sussex, when I spotted a pile of magazines in the corner of the manager's office. I asked what were they, and he said, cash boxes. Do you want them? Well, what could I say? Suddenly, I was ahead of the curve with the latest charts, news, and reviews from America. I was introduced to the hitherto unknown world of record distributors, jukebox operators, radio stations and disc jockeys, pressing plants, and most bewilderingly, one-stop operators. It took me so long to get my head around what was a one-stop operator. And very quickly, I was able to see that these were all the component parts of the wonderful independent record business. And it's those parts which no longer exist today, of course. Then I subscribed to Billboard, which I saw as inferior to Cashbox, but with hindsight had by far the better news coverage. So Cashbox and Billboard, with my record collection, have been invaluable basic research tools for my books, plus, as Tim says, the interviews. As an aside, I was able to interview all three Cashbox editors from the 1960s a few years ago in New York, and again gave me another perspective of the independent record business. So, thanks to my acquisitions of Cashbox and Billboard, Mike and I had re-established contact. By then, he was already compiling discographies, which would lead him to author the major discographical work, Blues Records, 1943 to 1946. We started writing to the independent record labels, which were advertising in those trade magazines. Some replied, others didn't. I remember getting photographs in a catalogue from Don Roby of Houston, Texas. And a little later, I ordered my Jimmy McCracklin Peacocks direct from Duke. Dorothy Keaton replied on behalf of Ernie Young of Excello Nashville Records in Nashville. Juggy Murray of Sioux sent his three latest Ike and Tina Turner albums, now worth at least $200 each. Paul Glass in Chicago sent a box of USA and Age 45s. Bob Shad sent three 45s for review and then submitted an invoice. Best of all, Mike received a big box of singles from Eddie Shuler of Gold Band Records out of Lake Charles in Louisiana. Among the many gems were 45s by Hop Wilson, Juke Boy Bonner, Clarence Garlow, Al Ferrier, Guitar Junior. Then there were the masterful Cajun 45s by Ari Lejeune and Cleveland Crotchet, who gave Eddie his only top 100 hit with Sugar Bee. It was the first time we knew this French music existed. And Mike went on, of course, to write about the music in Cajun Corner for Blues Unlimited. It was a major first. That box of 45s paid huge dividends, not only for us as writers and researchers, but also to Eddie Shuler and Gold Band Records. After founding the Blues Appreciation Society, Mike, with another Bexhill Grammar School student and another academic failure, was Simon Napier. Between them, they launched Blues Unlimited in April 1963. Simon brought a pre-war perspective to the magazine, also gospel and hillbilly music. Not only that, but he had a business instinct as an antiques record dealer that Mike never had. It was a great partnership. And so 200 stenciled copies of BU No. 1 were printed for sale at 1 shilling and 6 pence. From such humble beginnings became an internationally recognized magazine, which ran for 149 issues until the late 1980s. I know there are a few subscribers and supporters at this conference, including Chris Routwich, Dick Spotswood, and Dr. Rainer Lotz from Germany. Mike asked me to pen an article for that first issue. I told him, I've never written anything before and never had any ambition to do so. His response was, well, you've been buying those Excello 45s from Ernie's Record Mart in Nashville. You've had letters from Excello and the Louisiana record producer, Jay Miller. Write about Jay Miller and his artists, who, of course, include Slim Harpo, Lightning Slim, Lonesome Sundown, and Lazy Lester. And so thanks to Mike's cajoling, not only was I writing in Blues Unlimited number one, but I was also writing about a record man. I suppose Record Makers and Breakers, my latest book, was meant to be, even if it took another 46 years. Blues Unlimited's timing couldn't be better. The American Folk Blues Festivals were about to start in Europe. We would receive regular visits from Muddy Waters, Sonny Boy Williamson, Howlin' and Wolf. Think of these names. John Lee Hooker, Lightning Hopkins, Little Walter, Little Richard, Jimmy Reed. And later in 1967, with a stupendous performance, Fats Domino and his band. They're all wonderful, and they lived up to their reputations. And I have to say, including Jimmy Reed, who I think's got a very bad rap through the years, but was one of the major blues figures. So those are the R&B boom years in England, and were indeed heady times. In a way, you could understand how Chuck Berry and Bo Diddley made the UK pop charts. But how about this? Howlin' Wolf, Smokestack Lightning in the top 50 in 1964. As I say, heady times. By now, a new breed of writer and researcher was starting to appear in England, including Bruce Bastin, Mike Rowe, my good friend Dave Sachs, Tony Russell, the late and great Charlie Gillett, Bill Miller, Colin Escott, Martin Hawkins, and Rob Finnis. I just said that Colin Escott has perhaps made the biggest success of us all. He's just penned a Broadway musical, can you believe? Million Dollar Quartet. Perhaps the first millionaire of all of our writers. But it's fair to say that the great Paul Oliver was our mentor. Great man. We were all amateurs together, but we were gifted an open field because the universities of the time were not interested in this popular blues, R&B, hillbilly, and rock and roll. Thank you, those academic institutions. Jazz, of course, was a different matter, I hasten to add, Bruce. But along with the movies, America's music has proved to be one of its best international exports, and the country still doesn't properly recognize it to this day. I would add that the civil rights movement was a great motivational factor to us in the 1960s. But I realized that if I wanted to improve my knowledge and understanding, I had to visit the American homeland. And so in April 1970, with Mike Lebner and Robin Gosden, we flew out of Heathrow for New Orleans. We stayed at the home of Blues Unlimited subscriber James Rocker, who had just helped to rediscover Professor Longhair at the time. I didn't realize it, but James's mother, Connie, had run the New Orleans independent label Frisco Records between 1962 and 1966. Poor Connie's house on Canal Boulevard was completely destroyed by the collapse of the 17th Street levee in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. I know that one of our panelists today, Wardell Kazer, arranged and produced many of those Frisco releases in the early 60s. During a long weekend upon James's introductions, he was also our driver. We could have asked for more. We met and interviewed Professor Longhair, Huey Piano Smith, Archibald, Boogie Bill Webb, and Joe Banachak, the instant minute record man. All those interviews were taken in note form. There were still no tape recorders at the time. Really going back to the arc, isn't it? Then it hit me. These were forgotten men. New Orleans R&B at the time was a forgotten music. We were all besotted by Chicago blues and Southern down home blues. So I said to myself, let's try and do something about this and give something back for all the pleasure those artists have given us. And so the seeds of my first book were sown. With Leadbitter's prodding again, he kept saying, when are you going to write that New Orleans book? I embarked on writing the first draft. I would add that at the time I was building a career in Midland Bank, and all the writing and research was done in my holiday time at Notes and at weekends. No research grants here. After nervously handing the draft to Mike, he came back and said, is this it? The wonderful suggestion that he made was take out all that dry information, where people were born, who their parents were, where they died, and so on, and put it in the appendix. And that would help to improve the flow of the text. To this day, I see too many music history books without a decent appendix, and I think that's a cop-out. So after a major rewrite, Walking to New Orleans was published, as Tim said, in 1974. And Leadbitter said, I can't believe the transformation, but it was due to his advice that it was that much better. The book was in fact self-published by Simon Napier and myself under the name of Blues Unlimited. I shudder when I think about it. We had no publishing experience at all, and it was my very first book. What a deadly combination. But the premise was Blues Unlimited had 2,000 readers, and everybody in that period was so keen and devoted that we said, well, we're sure that half of the readers are going to buy the book, and that the magazine was the chief sort of advertising. And so it turned out. So how's that for back-of-the-envelope market research? The bulk of the interviews were carried out in 1973. It was not just the artists, but industry personnel, such as Cosmo Matassa, Marshall Seahorn, Alan Toussaint, Dave Bartholomew, even the backing musicians. The great thing was that the majority of my interviewees were living in New Orleans. And as we all know, many multi-generational families were dispersed by Katrina. And with them, a great research tool has been dissipated too. The main theme of the book was that rhythm and blues was a legitimate successor to the city's jazz heritage. That New Orleans R&B was a vital component in rock and roll music. And there was a compelling story with the genre's rise and fall. In today's parlance, the music was too big to fail in the long run. And so slide two. The rise and fall, this shows a rise and fall, that basic theme of New Orleans R&B from the late 1940s through to 1972. And I think you can see at the top there that Fats Domino was the constant. And I try to show the impact of the independent record labels, the Deluxe, Imperial, Specialty, Ace, Minute, Instant, Dover, and Sansu, particularly Imperial and Specialty in the 1950s. Fats Domino's very first record, The Fat Man, was a regional hit in early 1950. It represented a link to the New Orleans piano tradition and was a variant of Champion Jack Dupree's Junkers Blues. The over-modulated piano, which Dave Bartholomew, the producer, hated. Dave Bartholomew helped to make the record. And way down in the mix was the superb rhythmic drumming of Earl Palmer. It was the start of a great partnership between Fats and his producer and co-writer, Bartholomew. Here we are with The Fat Man. There's no doubt that Fats Domino and Dave Bartholomew created the sound of classic New Orleans R&B. And I think you can see in that photograph how Dave on the right is intense. And it was that intensity and discipline that made those, was part of the reason why those records were so great. And I love the tape recorder machinery at Cosmo's studio. Another hit for Lou Chudd's Imperial Records was Archibald Stacker Lee, which turned out to be a number one hit, as we all know, for New Orleans's Lloyd Price in 1959. This photo was taken at Archibald's house on our 1970 trip. He was so pleased to play his repertoire for us, which ranged from everything from the classics to New Orleans barrel house piano. And of course, Stacker Lee.
Went round the corner and he shot Stack in his side. Stacker Lee went stumbling in his mother do. He said, "Mother, oh mother, won't you turn me over slow? I've been jabbed in my left side with a police 44. And all the ladies for that stack, oh stacker."
I suppose the wonder was that Archibald still had a piano in his own home. But you can see what a wonderful stylist he was. Another interview in 1970 was Huey Piano Smith. "I couldn't believe how an artist who had major hits could be living in near poverty. After all, his music was the epitome of good time New Orleans R&B. And I'd like to give an example with this B-side, and all you record collectors out there will realize the wonders of the B-side. The top side was Popeye, which was a medium-sized hit, the dance craze. But here we have, with the great Lee Allen on tenor saxophone and Red Tyler on baritone sax, a fairly unknown record called School Dog."
He was running like a star dog.
Star dog.
He was running through the smoke. He was running through the fog. He was running.
Great Huey Smith with the equally great Charles Hungry Williams on drums. And the lyrics weren't exactly a matter of high art, but the thing about Huey was, and he told us, that he was adept at picking out child's nursery rhymes and turning them into songs. And I said to him, "What do you mean?" And immediately started composing a song based on "What do you mean?" A prime factor in the popularity of New Orleans R&B, Fats Domino's hit records apart, was the drumming of Earl Palmer. As Cyril Vetter, I'm very pleased to see, has come down from Baton Rouge, told me recently, if Earl had been able to patent his drum licks, he would have been a billionaire like Bill Gates. And I think the effect that he's had on New Orleans rhythm and blues and rock and roll generally is quite phenomenal. Wonderful drummer, started out as a dancer, and it was that dancing ability which no doubt gave him that rhythmic quality. And as Dave Bartholomew told me, Earl's drumming is impeccable. And Dave said that take after take after take, Earl would finish spot on to the second. Another factor in the greatness of New Orleans R&B was the cohesive brilliance of Cosmo Matassa's studio group. And here we have a lovely photograph of a Shirley and Lee session taken around 1956. I wonder if it's at the time when they recorded Let the Good Times Roll. But from the left, you have the guitarist Justin Adams. You have the second left, the pianist Frank Edward Frank. Behind the microphone, you can just see Lee Allen, and Red Tyler is on the far right. By 1960, Dave Bartholomew's run with Fats was drying up. It was a natural change of the guard. He'd been at it for 10 years, and younger A&R men were coming in, giving a funkier edge to the music. I know that two of those participants, Waddell Kazare and Harold Baptiste, will be joining us later. They were young men then, now they are veterans. Then there was another important young man, Alan Toussaint. Here we have Alan in the glorious plaid jacket standing next to Tommy Ridgely. One of Alan's early influential hits, and we know that Alan is still going strong to this day and he's a great proponent of New Orleans music, but one of his early hits was, again, a great lyrical piece, Ooh Papa Doo, by Jesse Hill for Minute. But here's part two, featuring David Lasty on tenor sax, Ooh Papa Doo. Thank you. Yes, you can imagine the great thrill, having bought Oop Oop A Doo by Jesse Hill and London American, to find that track on the flip side. Another genius behind the New Orleans R&B sound is Cosmo Matassa. Here he is seen in his studio with teen star Jimmy Clanton. In 1970, we would visit his second, well, the studio following that, Jazz City Studio on Camp Street. And here are the researchers. James Rocker on the left, Mike Lebeter with his massive research bag, and Robin Gosden, who later was a director of Fly Right Records, the distributors in Bexhill again. It's salutary to think that Mike died some 4 years after that photograph of meningitis, aged only 32. Sadly, his astonishing, and it is astonishing, Delta Blues manuscript has never been published. To finish off this New Orleans segment, there has been some confusion over the titles of my book, Walking to New Orleans, and Rhythm and Blues in New Orleans. Very briefly, Dr. Milburn Cahoon of Pelican Books wanted to take the book, and it was great of him to do so. But he thought the American audience would not understand the significance of the title Walking to New Orleans. So the simplistic Rhythm and Blues in New Orleans it was. But of course, the world was a smaller place, and who knew that one day we'd have the multimedia that we have today. So we're all one place. Then we thought, Walking to New Orleans in England, Rhythm and Blues in New Orleans over here. But to his credit, Dr. Calhoun found a market among the New Orleans tourists that we could never have found from the record collector-orientated readership of Blues Unlimited. And to date, the sales are in excess of 20,000, and it's still in print. I'm delighted to say that New Orleans R&B, the research has continued through the works of Jeff Hanisch, Rick Coleman, and the late and great Tad Jones. Tad's family is actively seeking a publisher for his landmark research on Louis Armstrong. I hope they succeed. I must acknowledge here the broadening mission of the Tulane Jazz Archives under Bruce Rayburn. Thank you, Bruce. Also the magazines Wavelength and Offbeat. The Jazz Festival, we mustn't forget that. And of course, the wonderful Dr. Ike and the Ponderosa Stomp, who we're going to see later on. Then Dr. Calhoun asked me for a follow-up and give me a firm commission. I said I'd love to write a book on South Louisiana music. I knew that Cajun, Zydeco, Rockabilly and Swamp Blues would be accepted. I wasn't so sure about Swamp Pop, wondering if it would be too commercial or just pop. I needn't have worried. Swamp Pop is now viewed as a legitimate part of the Cajun culture. The saxophonist Harry Cimino with Johnny Allen, I think, said it best. He said, Swamp Pop is half Fado Do, half Fats Domino. But it amuses me to think that literally the terminology was coined in England, and the reason was because up until that point, it was called South Louisiana Rock and Roll. Rather a mouthful, and it wasn't all rock and roll either. So we were introduced to Phil Phillips, Johnny Allen, Bobby Charles, and Cookie and His Cupcakes, and so on. So back to the 1970 trip. After New Orleans, we visited Cajun country and met the still active record men, including Eddie Shuler of Gold Band Records, which for a while was the subsidiary of the lucrative quick service TV business in Lake Charles. How about this wonderful photo? That's Eddie and his crew in 1955, just as Gold Band was about to take off, and Eddie and his wife, Elsie, are seen on the far right. Eddie, his biggest hit was Sea of Love, which everybody knows. That was recorded in that little studio there. But his biggest legacy is, of course, Irene Lejeune, and the Gold Band archives are now safely held in the Southern Folklife Collection in Chapel Hill. We also visited record men Leda Verne in Church Point, Jay Miller in Crowley, Floyd Swallow in Ville Platte. These two photographs were taken by Mike Lepeter on his trip in 1967. Miller was a fascinating man who was the subject of that article of mine in Blues Unlimited number one. He was best known for his swamp blues recordings, including those by Slim Harpo. And here is one of his best.
Bottles on the table here. Yeah? I knew I didn't drink all this by myself. I must have had a blues hangover. What's this?
That's really the blues, isn't it? Both Miller and Swallow also recorded one of the Cajun greats, Nathan Abshire, and this photograph has recently turned up through the research of Andrew Brown and Lyle Fibracci, who've just started this wonderful new magazine called Louisiana Music. It shows that new photographs, new research is still turning up the whole time. But here's Nathan's theme song. I'm sure you all know it. This was recorded for Swallow Records, Pine Grove Blues. I love the coffee cup on the chair and also the beer bottles underneath. That's really Cajun music. Since South of Louisiana, there have been further books by Anne Allen Savoy, Barry Ancelet, Johnny Allen, a wonderful photo book, Shane Bernard, who's written on Swamp Pop, Kevin Fontenot, and recently Tom Aswell. After my banking career was over in 1991, and I hasten to say when bankers were respected members of the local community, I applied my music research by joining Ace Records, and there I was able to put my music knowledge into practice in the business. And altogether, I guess I produced some 250 CDs, including some from the catalogues of Harold Baptiste AFO Records and Connie LaRocca's Frisco Records. If only I could have done a deal with Wardell Cazares' marvellous Nola Masters, but the ownership was such a mess that it was just not possible. During my time at Ace, I visited tape vaults in Decca in London, King, Excello, Fantasy, which included Stax and Specialty, Challenge, and Chris Trowbridge's Ahuli Records. I was able to witness firsthand the need for preservation and careful transferring of master tapes. I also understood the frustrations, and it really was, of licensing the great independent label catalogues from the major labels. In 1993, I went to Long Island to discuss the licensing of the Wailers, who had two top 40 hits, Golden Crest Masters from the owner, Clark Galehouse. He was no longer alive. His estate had been inherited by his daughter, Shelley. And so I ended up signing two contracts, one for Ace Records and the other in marriage to Shelley. So I now live on Long Island. With Ace, I continued to meet fascinating record men such as Hi Weiss of Old Town, Joe Behari of Modern, Morty Craft, as well as old friends Harold Baptiste, Jay Miller, Eddie Shuler, and Floyd Swallow. So the logical result was Record Makers and Breakers, which was based on my interviews through the years. I'm going to come near the end now, but I just must quote from the fronts piece of the book, a quote from none other than Mike Lebbard, who I think you can see has been such an influence on me and so many others. Mike wrote in Blues Unlimited in 1970, "These are the men," and I put in brackets, "and women who knew. Their importance cannot be overestimated, and attempts should be made to interview." And so the book was published last year by the University of Illinois Press. I'd just like to run through a series of slides now. If we could just go to slide 15, we won't play any more music, just go through the slides. That really just shows the upward curve of the business since the post-war years, when the independent labels started to really take off. Next slide. And there you are, isn't it wonderful? Just masterpieces of art and of music. That's what the record business is about. Next slide, please. The King Records pressing plant. These independent record guys, very often they had to learn how to press records themselves, and they created their own pressing plants. And that's one of the elements of why I admire them so much. They were really can-do people. Next slide. This is King Records. The outrageous Sid Nathan, you can see him on the left-hand side of the trade stand there. But already in 1947, it's shown that there's some sophistication to the business. That really is very, very good marketing indeed. And one of the features of King Records was its branch office network. And that's the Nashville office. It acted as a distributing centre, but also as a centre for discovering talent. You can just see the Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey sign on the right-hand side. Next slide, please. Perhaps the best known of all the independent labels, Atlantic. What a wonderful picture that is. Jerry Wexler, Ahmet Ertegun, and Miriam Abramson, as she was now Miriam Beanstock. I was very privileged to interview all three of those, and just gave me such a lovely story. They've given stories to others, but I was just focused on the record business aspect. And there you can see Ruth Brown, the Clovers, Joe Turner, and Clyde McFatter and the Drifters. And that picture to me almost sums up the independent record era. Next slide. Just to say that I've been doing some research on an unknown New Orleans R&B artist, Earlene Harris, and Bruce has been a great help as well. The great thing was that her daughter has got a wonderful archive of photographs and ephemera that her mother kept when she was an artist for Deluxe and Regal in 1949 into the early 50s. So here we have Earlene Harris, and in doing that research, I came up, Dan Kachakian got this lovely photograph of Plaz Johnson with his brother Ray on the left. Plaz, as we all know, is one of the great tenor sax players from New Orleans. So again, that's a beautiful of ongoing research. It leads you into directions that you sometimes don't anticipate. So, ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to conclude by just saying that it's been a real pleasure here to be here with you, and I hope you've enjoyed my talk. I hope I've also been able to give you an indication of just how great the new the music of New Orleans has been, and also South Louisiana, and I contend it still is. So thank you very much indeed. Thank you.